But before we get to Stan, let's come back to that idea of beauty in the everyday. Leaving aside the subjectivity of aesthetic judgment, what value is there in this seemingly endless quest for the beautiful, for some idea of perfection? There's a new book out by curator and architecture writer Karen McCartney that explores the Japanese Zen philosophy of wabi-sabi. That's the idea of finding perfection in the imperfect, celebrating aesthetic value in the weathered, the worn, and the generally beaten up. Her book is called Perfect Imperfect, The Beauty of Accident, Age, and Patina, and she joins us now. Hi, Karen. How did I go? Did I describe wabi-sabi adequately?
Oh, you were perfectly imperfect there.
that's what I go for. That's my speciality. talk us through it, because it's rooted in Zen Buddhism. Where does the tradition of wabi-sabi come from?
It's a very interesting kind of deeply held Japanese philosophy. And so when people ask me sort of for sound bites, like, is it a bit of a trend? I always feel deeply uncomfortable because it's a sort of this quintessential Japanese aesthetic. And it's the beauty of the imperfect, the impermanent and the incomplete and also things with a modesty and a humbleness. There's a wonderful book by Leonard Corin called Wabi Sabi for Artists, Designers, Poets and Philosophers. And that's the book I would recommend even over mine that people read on this subject, because it gives a really beautiful understanding of the nuances. We've taken some of those principles, but actually also dialed it up into a sort of modernity, in that we've looked at current designers and how they use process and how they embrace accident in their work, and then what those outcomes are.
You clearly don't understand the principles of promoting a book. Don't plug Leonard Corin's book above your own. But I do like, there's that quote from the Corin book that says, wabi-sabi is about beauty coaxed out of ugliness. So it doesn't deny the ugly state of the thing, but that beauty is somehow in there to be drawn up to the surface.
I absolutely love that. And I collaborated very closely on this book with the photographer Sharon Cairns and the stylist Glenn Probstall. And we worked together to kind of really tell this story in pictures and words. And because we were working all over the world, Glenn's in New York, Sharon is in Melbourne, I'm in Sydney, I sort of drew up a bit of a list of things that I felt we all needed to hold in our heads when we were looking for subjects and looking for content for this book. And that was one of the key things, because it's quite a tricky thing to get your head around. And there is something about beauty in the eye of the beholder. But how do you find that point? And actually, we find it in a chair that it was slightly contentious for us to begin with, because when you're collaborating with people, even if you have a very clear goal, we all come at it from slightly different perspectives.
Tell us about that chair. Bring the chair to life.
Well, the chair it's called the Well Proven Chair. It was designed by young designers, James Shaw and Marianne von Aboul. And they were looking at the properties of reusing materials. And so what they did, they discovered that if they combined a sort of bio-resin with wood shavings that were from the factory floor, and then they put them on the back of this chair, and it sort of did a sort of strange alchemy overnight, and it hardened into this sort of carapace on the back of the chair that looks almost volcanic. So it's definitely on the borderline of ugly and beautiful. But it was a chair that my husband put me onto for this project. And, you know, it was a bit of a challenge for Glenn and Sharon to photograph this chair. But they have made it look so wonderful, because it's shot in a very old house in Shoreditch in London. So you've got that great sense of patina and age and history combined with this very contemporary chair, which is quite challenging to look at.
It is extraordinary. I mean, it's this lump and shape that looks like it's kind of black lava, and the chair's kind of emerged from it. But that's not accident. I mean, as you describe it, that comes from a very careful bit of craft. In modern design, how much is this just the aesthetic of the rough hewn rather than happenstance getting us to that ugliness?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the chairs come out within a sort of realm of, you know, one has a similar look to the other, but no two are the same. So there is this, the accident is in the process. And, you know, it's interesting, a lot of the people that we interviewed, we chose them because of their aesthetics. But when we began to talk to them, boy, did they over-deliver in terms of how this was so much at the heart of their practice. You know, talking to one ceramicist, she said, well, I asked about accident. She goes, well, hey, we, you know, we commit our work to fire. You know, you don't get much more elemental and you know, so accident or some...
She was the Tasmanian one, wasn't she?
She's called Nicola Tazzy, and she is in London. And she also, you know, a lot of it is about observation. At least two of the people in the book, the sculptor Alison Coates and Nicola Tazzy, said a lot of it was about observing accidents. So in the case of Nicola Tazzy, she had put rejects up on a shelf and they'd sort of slightly slumped into one another like they were sort of a bit tipsy. And in observing this, she then took that idea and created a range where there's no utility in these objects, but they slump and she's glazed some in a beautiful salad and called one of something, you know, with a Hogarth in it, referring to, you know, drunken sort of works. And so it's about observing accident and seeing the potential in accident and understanding how you can draw on that. Because, you know, we're all so busy, we just sort of work through things. Oh, those things have fallen. Have they fallen beautifully? Well, do we observe that or not? And I think that's the thing of these artists. They observe the happenstance.
Those ceramic examples are particularly acute. And as you say, part of it is the artistic practice relies on something like fire that's going to be unpredictable and kind of changeable every time. But how do you apply these design principles then across something like interior design? Because how do you get the mix of it? If it's serendipity and happenstance, it can't be reproduced again and again, can it?
That's the joy of it, you see. I mean, it was interesting, we don't have many architects in the book because architects tend to like precise lines. But the one architect we have featured is John Wardle, and it's his Bruny Island Shearer's Quarters, which is an award-winning project. But he is a collector, and so the place is filled with things that he has acquired, and he collects everything from Apple paraphernalia and mechanical things through to books and shells he's found on the beach. And then he finds ways to put those things together that are quite inspiring and beautiful. For example, his books, Behind the Fire, they start with the orange and red covers and segue as it becomes cooler to the green and blue covers. So these kind of thoughtful plays on things, you know, they're quite touching. His mother apparently was a librarian, so it's something of a family joke the way he approaches his books. But again, that sort of, there's a lightness and there's a play and an understanding of how things can come together that's both aesthetically pleasing and often functional as well.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living, and I'm talking with Karen McCartney about her new book that looks into the idea of wabi-sabi, beauty in the everyday and in the imperfect. The other thing about that kind of curated chaos that comes from selecting these things for interior spaces is the potential for it to much more readily reflect the individual values and personalities of the person in question, presumably.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, one of the places that we featured is by these kind of celebrity, which doesn't really go with wabi-sabi at all, celebrity, but they're high-end American designers called Roman and Williams. And they started on film sets and working with Ben Stiller. And they have a country place in Montauk where their personality is so completely and utterly expressed because it's collected and found and characterful and beaten up and different textures and old sea prints that they have all together on a wall. And it's not about expense and spending a lot of money. It's about a kind of a sort of dedication to that expression of your personality. And they say that of all the projects they've done, it's still the most quoted back to them. It really resonates with people, and that is because it's utterly and truly them.
So then what if people want to embrace the spirit of this in their own kind of home, in their own kind of aesthetic? Where do you even begin?
Well, you know, there is a fine line between mess and creative clutter.
Yeah, not that fine, I wouldn't have thought.
Exactly. And so I think it's about, honestly, conviction and caring about it. It doesn't just, like anything in life, it doesn't just happen. You need to make it happen, and you need to think about it, and you need to plan it. But once you decide, I'm going to collect seascapes from charity shops, and you do that with a degree of commitment, and you get 20 of them, and you put them up on a wall. You know, none of it is actually hard. It's just having the desire to do it and make it happen. But it doesn't happen by itself.
One of the things you point to in the book is that that Western practice of when something's broken, it's done and we throw it out. And the fact that part of the appeal of this is seeing the new beauty of the half-mended or the worn and torn thing. Can you talk a little bit about Angkor Wat and the copper ice cream scoops?
Well, this was one of the things that actually really, it was like a ka-ching moment for me. I talked to Guy Coulomans, who designed the ice cream scoops, and what was interesting was he wanted to recreate the famous 1930s aluminium ice cream scoop, and he thought, oh, well, copper is even more conductive, I'll do it in copper. But what he found, it was such a volatile material that the company that he got to try, they sent him back the unworkable version as a non-chargeable failure. And it was like something that had been dug up from an archaeological site. It was all eroded and corroded and matte. And he then did a perfect version where he infilled it with tin. And this is the perfect, shiny, complete, but all the eroded bits that are filled with tin are very evident. And so he then began to explore that idea of the fracture, and looked at Japan and how the fracture, you know, something would be broken but then filled with gold and became more precious as a result. Whereas here, you know, I was thinking about, you know, that idea of, you know, if you've got a woolen or cashmere sweater and the moths get it, you know, we tend to think, oh, it's done, rather than getting a beautiful blue thread and you know, stitching it, because we're trained to believe that the mend is a failure or declares our poverty or an actual fact. This turning it on its head and giving it a new life is actually a very beautiful notion.
Karen McCartney, you've given a beautiful philosophy behind my general demeanour of shabbiness, and I'm grateful to you, no end. Karen McCartney, curator and author of many books on architecture. Her latest book is Perfect Imperfect, The Beauty of Accident, Age and Patina, and it's out now from Murdoch Books. And Canberra's Hotel, the Nishi Gallery there is going to have an exhibition of objects from the book, overseas and local, which runs until the 8th of May.